welcome to the hashtag Faring Pod. At Faring, people come first. In this episode, we're going to be discussing bedwetting. What is bedwetting? What are some of the causes of bedwetting in kids? And ultimately, I think we want to get to the place where we understand, you know, when do we become concerned about, you know, our children's bedwetting? And what are the types of treatments that we would recommend for bedwetting? It's going to be an interesting conversation. And I am very fortunate to be joined by our wonderful guest, Dr. Nicu Lawrence. Welcome, a warm welcome to you, Dr. Nicu. And maybe just to kickstart the conversation, tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice. What does it entail?
Thanks so much, and thank you for having me. So I'm a urologist, qualified about 5 years ago, and primarily interested in pediatric urology, so children's urology. I'm based at Steve Biko Academic Hospital, which is the large referral hospital here in Pretoria. I am primarily responsible for pediatric urology there. So at Steve Biko, I only attend to children's urology. And then part of one of the realms of pediatric urology is the management of incontinence in children, of course. And part of that is then bedwetting, or as we say in the formal medical term, enuresis. I'm also based at the Pretoria Urology Hospital after hours and over weekends. But yeah, basically between those two and keen interest in children's urology.
Okay, so I'm just listening to that introduction of yourself. I am very assured that we are in good hands to have this conversation around bedwetting. And I think a starting point is, what is bedwetting? You made mention of that very fancy word. What is it? Enuresis.
Enuresis.
Enuresis. 100%. What is bedwetting?
So bedwetting is basically, we can use it in both context of a child, but also in the context of an adult. And that's a patient or a person that goes to bed, falls asleep, and then has an episode of incontinence or leakage of urine while they're asleep. Mm. That's the basic or most basic definition of bedwetting. I think it's also important just to mention that bedwetting and incontinence is not the same. So the leakage of urine, when a person is awake, or when, for instance, a child is in bed but awake, that does not constitute bedwetting. So it's important to make that distinction, because the treatment basically is different, and also the workup for a patient or a child that presents with those symptoms are different from bedwetting.
And maybe just to facilitate my own understanding, what we're saying is that bedwetting happens when somebody is asleep.
Absolutely.
Whereas
Absolutely.
Incontinence is that lack of ability to control oneself. Absolutely. Regardless.
Absolutely. And if you wake up just before you have an episode of wetting yourself, that is still technically incontinence. So the person is asleep and they remain asleep and then wake up because they feel they're wet.
Mm.
Right. That's basically what bedwetting constitutes. Just a technical term there, and there's also a distinction to be made between bedwetting that occurs when a child has never been dry, so we call that primary enuresis. So that's basically a child that grew up, was potty trained, and then since birth has never been dry at night. And then there's an distinction between that and, for instance, secondary enuresis. This is a child that was dry, so a child reached the age of 5 and then went and slept through without ever wetting the bed for a period of at least 6 months, and then afterwards again started bedwetting. And it's important because usually if we go onto the history of these secondary enuresis, you can then understand or look for something specifically, some trigger that might have led. And often you'd find it's a new sibling in the house. That's probably one of the most common reasons.
Mm. And I think what we'll do now is actually to move to how does one identify bedwetting symptoms, etc. But, you know, in fact, before symptoms, I want to talk to what are the causes of bedwetting in kids. And I'm thinking about how at some point when our kids were going to sleep, we used to say things like, don't take water to bed. Don't have water 1 hour before you go to bed. Because we knew that, you know, that was almost one of the things that would guarantee us waking up, the following day with a wet bed.
True.
But take me through what some of the causes are of bed wetting in kids.
So basically, there are three main causes of bed wetting. And I'm going to ask the listener here to, in their mind, just imagine, basically, as a child grows, everything grows. All the organs, the heart, the liver. And one of the things that also grows is the bladder. So a bladder is basically an organ where urine is stored until such a point where it's convenient socially to pass urine, right? Technically, bedwetting is only diagnosable from the age of 5 onwards. But I mean, this is for the experts. This is for basically what the textbooks tell us. And it's important to realize that when a person falls asleep, your brain actually produces a certain hormone, we call that AVP, and that hormone reduces the amount of urine that is produced during sleep.
Mm.
So it's one of the components. In children, this system of AVP, this hormone being produced, is still immature. And it actually matures sometimes a little bit later after 5. That's one of the main components, and that's also one of the areas on which the therapeutic or the treatment is focused, and that's the aspect of giving AVP. The second thing is bladder capacity, and that then links up with what I said while the child is growing.
Mm.
A child has a small bladder capacity, but also the way in which a child grows and then their bodily systems mature to realize, listen, my bladder is full, I'm in grade 1 or grade R, I'm in class, I can't just pass urine right now, is different from an infant. Because if you have a child that's wearing a nappy, they just pass in urine spontaneously, and that's actually a reflex.
Mm.
So part of the normal development is a bladder capacity that increases, can accommodate more urine.
Mm.
That reflex that basically is suppressed, stop. So the patient then, or the child then, voids in a socially acceptable place. And then the last, and this is very important, especially we see this in children that have attention deficit disorders, so ADD and ADHD, and that's deep sleep. The majority of patients or children that are bedwetters have some component of sleeping very deeply. And often when I see a mom, she'd present and come to me and say, you know, doctor, my child, the house can burn down. I cannot wake him up. And that is, so if you add those three into a mix, you end up with a perfect storm, and that's often bedwetting that progresses and then persists after the age of 5 years old.
I mean, we're talking ages. This is insightful for me, doctor. We're talking ages, and we speak about how, for the most part, when a child is much smaller, it's that reflex. And then, of course, as they develop, that bladder capacity is developing, but also that AVP system is starting to develop and to mature. Take us through the ages. So typically, when do we expect that the AVP system is developed enough or the bladder capacity has increased enough for a child to then stop kind of wetting the bed? Take me through the ages.
So it depends on which system develops the fastest. So often it is the case of AVP actually being there and being effective at the age of 5. So technically, if a child still wets a bed at the age of 5, that's enuresis or bed wetting. But then the child might be a very deep sleeper. And that's the majority or the main component that's contributing towards a child still wetting their bed. And so there's not an absolute cutoff where, but in each person, it's an individual. But basically, if all of these three systems have matured, then you'll have a person that hopefully has a normal bladder capacity for his or her age, that would be awoken with a full bladder. And then also where the DDAVP or the arginine vasopressin, that fancy hormone, is an actual fact, produced in sufficient quantities. Because there's also other medical conditions like diabetes or hypertension that comes to play in all the patients, obviously in adults, that has an impact on the production of the AVP.
Yeah.
For instance, alcohol in adults, if you take alcohol, it suppresses AVP, so that's often why you wake up with a full bladder, not only because you had 4 beers, but because the alcohol in the beers suppresses the production of the hormone. So it's a bit more complex than just black and white, yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing that, but again, I'm sitting with a question where, and I link this to kind of, you know, the old wives' tales, things that we hear. So I've got a child who is 4 years old, who wets their bed. I share with my friends that my child is wetting their bed. They go, ah, it's okay, it's normal. 3 years down the line, this child is now 7 years old and they're still wet in their bed. So for me, I still sit with the question that says, you know, at what age then should we expect bed wetting to stop?
So I think it's also to perhaps touch on the hereditary aspect of bed wetting. So often if I see a patient or a child for bedwetting, and I'm going to take a full history, I'm going to ask the parents, is there anybody in your family, a brother or sister, or yourselves, a mom or a dad, that also had bedwetting as a child? And there is a rough guide, or you can guesstimate, that the age when both parents, if they were bedwetters, turned dry, probably the child, the age that the child turned dry. So if the mom or the dad was still bedwetting at 7, barring all external influences like trauma, etc., then that's probably the age at which the child will become dry as well. I think it's also just important, you're speaking about the age when we'd expect. We have to first, when we see a child and approach, have an approach of the treatment for the bedwetting, exclude other things. So we're going to screen for diabetes. Mm. Is this a condition that is perhaps driven by not only the fact that the child is wetting in bed, but also incontinent during the day?
Mm.
And that's where, just once again, the technical terms, we speak of monosymptomatic, so a single symptom, bedwetting or enuresis, and that's the topic that we're discussing today. So monosymptomatic enuresis, a child has no other symptoms, growing well, no daytime incontinence. That's very important to emphasize that. So this is a child that would, while they're awake, ask the teacher, ma'am, sir, I'd like to go to the loo, I need to pass urine, and they're able to hold their urine until they get, so socially when they're awake, they're incontinent, they're not going to have a small accident, but the issue comes when they're asleep. And when we move into the ambit of non-monosymptomatic, so there's more than one symptom in enuresis, this is where we eventually start going into daytime incontinence, overactivity. So what overactivity means is that feeling that you constantly want to pass urine, and that's a whole different diagnosis or condition, because there we start looking for secondary causes. So other things, nerve problems, diseases like diabetes, etc., that we need to exclude first.
So, doctor, you know, I'm thinking about at which stage would a parent, decide that I now need to take my child to go see a urologist for bedwetting?
Absolutely. I think that's a very relevant question. And basically, there's two instances that I can think of immediately. Intrafamilial or stress in the family. Often single parents that have stressful jobs, or where it becomes so difficult, there's perhaps a second child or a third child that comes into the fold. These parents are at their wit's end.
Mm.
So mom comes, she's perhaps a sole breadwinner, or she is completely responsible at home, and she says, doctor, I don't sleep, highly strung, under a lot of pressure, I really need help. So often that would be one of the reasons why parents come, but also anticipating the possible complications or issues that a child can have growing up. So at 5, a child is probably in what, grade R, grade 0, going to grade 0, but not yet in primary school.
Mm.
And then at 6, going to grade 1, it is the interaction with friends.
Mm.
So unfortunately, it's a realistic, we need to admit it, that children can be quite vindictive with one another.
Mm.
And if you're on a sport camp, or you're sleeping out with a friend, parents don't ever want their children to be the one that's victimized or laughed at. Right? And it's an embarrassing thing. I think many children that eventually do end up bedwetting into their teens are shy. They shy away from social interaction. They sometimes struggle with relationships, specifically romantic relationships, because if you eventually get there, you're shy of bearing yourself to your potential boyfriend, girlfriend, partner. So that's basically, so going from normal social interaction to eventually end up in a romantic relationship, that's part of why I think it's important, and why parents bring their children to address this issue.
I mean, just listening to that, I'm even thinking about how sometimes that stigma starts at home.
Absolutely.
So if your child is bedwetting, you know, as parents, you start to feel a little bit embarrassed. There's a little bit of shame that's associated with it. Is there something wrong with my child? Absolutely. Is there something I didn't do right, et cetera. And I think it's important for us to really look at the psychological impact, or that emotional impact that it has on children, and to look at how we can even start with giving that support from home.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an important one.
Absolutely. I think one of to the parents listening today, I think it's important to emphasize this point, and that's admonishing your child, and also placing punitive measures. So, I mean, spanking aside, which is a controversial subject, but penalizing your child for wetting the bed is going to have the completely opposite effect. These children eventually withdraw into themselves. If you had an outgoing, boisterous, engaging, extrovert type of child, you're going to turn them into something that you don't recognize. So I want to, while it's important to have very strict guidelines or very strict guidelines in place as to how we're going to approach this, I think one of the important things that I always tell parents is once the child is old enough to make the beds, it's important that the mother initially helps the child to make the bed, but it's not the mom or the helper's responsibility to change the bed once it's wet. Mm. You wet the bed, and I think it's important that we'll help you, but perhaps not 2 o'clock in the morning, but eventually you have to change the bed, because that's also a little bit of realization that you accept, listen, it's my issue, I'm going to change the linen, and also that I'm going to fight this. Because I've had many patients that present children that initially for a year or two struggle with bedwetting. Once they achieve continence at night, once they dry at night, it's amazing how to see the self confidence that a child gains once they turn dry.
I mean, I'm loving this conversation purely because I'm a mother myself, and I do have two little people. So the one is 9 years old, and so she's past that stage. And so I think it's important to be armed with the information to understand this, because this will guide some of how we respond. And I can remember there was a time with a 9-year-old when she was kind of wetting her bed and we were getting anxious that she's not moving past it, when we did admonish her. There was a time when we felt like maybe we need to put some punitive measures. And even if it wasn't slapping her, but it was taking away a privilege. And I think it's important. I'm sitting here feeling a little bit ashamed, actually. But I think as I become more aware and start to understand the subject a little bit better, there's an opportunity for me to respond differently with the other two.
And also the converse to that is also true. Bring a reward system. The dry night sticker, reward, sleep out, ice cream, anything. I mean, insert reward here. Where you engage your child, put a sticker sheet or whatever on the door, and for each dry night you have a golden sticker. Right? Just something that there is a realization on the child's behalf as well. This is my responsibility. I am able to win this. And once they achieve that they have that sense of satisfaction and achievement. Because at the end of the day, I think any child is still ashamed once they realize this is me. I don't want to be in my bed. It is an inconvenience. Everybody's like looking, oh, Johnny, you know, he's the bed wetter. And there's something that can be an albatross around a child's neck.
100%. Doctor, is there value in sitting with your child and having a conversation with them about it? So saying, look, this is what's happening. Are they able to respond to why they're wetting the bed?
No, absolutely. I think it's very important. They might not be able to immediately, especially the deep sleepers and those children that haven't had the full development of their blood. I mean, there's not something that they can do to speed that up. That needs to happen with time, and they'll change it with time. I think it's important just for their own insight and to have their buy-in that this is something that we're going to fight together. It's not me being left alone by my parents, and that they don't want to have anything to do with me because it's smelly and it's an embarrassment. This is a fight that we're fighting together, and I need your buy-in as a child, because this is what we're going to do at dinner. We are going to limit the amount of fluid, and you're not going to, behind my back, sneak to the fridge and get another glass of iced tea or Coke or whatever. Just so that they realize, listen, if you do that, you're breaking the pact that you and I have made. So there's a bit of a pact or agreement that you have with your children or with the patient.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm also thinking that in having the conversation, it could also afford a parent an opportunity to investigate if they of some kind of trauma. And maybe my follow-on question to that is, can bedwetting be a sign of trauma?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is difficult to specifically identify whether it's sexual trauma or emotional abuse or whatever. But I think it's important that yes. In a specific situation, perhaps a single parent, perhaps a foster child, if there is persistent bedwetting, it's important to explore. You need to go down that route. If, for instance, a child comes to me and he or she is coming with a foster parent, try and see. I mean, is there any, we call them the so-called red flags. Are there any red flags? During your physical examination, is there anything that's untoward? Perhaps also get collateral information from the teachers at school. Is there untoward sexualization of this child at a younger age? Just to see that there's not something that you miss. Because obviously, if there is, and bedwetting is not usually the only symptom that it presents with, there's usually other symptoms as well, like soiling yourself. So encopresis, these children that have undergone abuse or trauma often soil themselves. So there's more than just simple bedwetting, and it's usually incontinence, daytime incontinence as well. So it's not just bedwetting at night. But yes, if it's persistent, just basic screening for that is important, I think.
And maybe just to unpack the word trauma a little bit, kind of what do we mean by trauma? And I'm sitting here going, is it traumatic when, you know, a new sibling comes into the home?
No.
Is that classified as a trauma?
I think it is. I think in some form it's an emotional, it's because for a firstborn child, the arrival of a second sibling is always something that's traumatic. Is this person, this new person now is going to usurp my attention, my monopoly that I had on mommy or daddy? So I do think that is a form of trauma, and we shouldn't basically negate or discard that because we're not in that position as the parents or the caregivers of the children. So it's important to perhaps explain and to engage in your children on that level, because I feel that's perhaps the slightest of traumas that would occur that might be explained. And obviously from there onwards, other forms of trauma that I've referred to. But yes, I think that is something that we could classify as trauma.
Okay. Can bedwetting be treated, doctor? I think we're sitting with that question now, wondering, can this be treated?
Parents listening like that, can we just get to the important stuff? Can bedwetting be treated? So yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to emphasize to all the despondent parents out there that might have a child that is already in primary school, who still is afraid to sleep out, who is socially engaging but turning into a shy child because of their fear, stigma, and the shame associated with bedwetting, is completely treatable. So just by the age of 5, according to the ICS, International Continence Society, and the ICCS, Children's Continence Society, children should attain nocturnal continence. So they should be dry at night and not wet their beds. But there will be little mishaps here and there in the majority of children. That's still considered normal, right? But once bedwetting becomes regular, or if they after the age of 5 persist at night, most evenings in a week, to wet their beds, that is when parents should seek help. There are various forms of treatment that we're going to discuss now. And I think the most important is basically the conservative management, and then therapeutics, or the treatment that we can give, like medicine for the bedwetting. One of the basic things that we should start discussing is this something that only occurs at night while the child is sleeping? So are we really dealing with bedwetting? If the child is at any way incontinent during the day, so has daytime incontinence, it's technically no longer just monosymptomatic bedwetting or enuresis. And there we are going to look further. We're going to have a lower threshold to do some special investigations or scans to make sure that we're not dealing with, for instance, spina bifida that wasn't diagnosed at birth, a developmental abnormality, a bladder abnormality, or anything like that. Part of that evaluation will include a basic urinalysis, that's just looking at the urine on a dipstick, basic urine dipstick test, just to exclude basic things like, is there blood? Is your child having recurrent urinary tract infections? Once all of these things come into play, that is going to guide us in a certain direction to do further scans or special x-rays or whatever, just to exclude other causes that could be having bedwetting as a symptom as well. Once we've excluded all of those things, part of the basic non-treatment or non-pharmacotherapy things that we're going to assess is how is your child's normal routine in terms of passing urine, in terms of passing stool. We need to exclude constipation in a child with bedwetting. It's called, there's actually a term for this, it's bladder-bowel dysfunction, BBD. And once we've examined a child, or done a basic x-ray just to see if there is what we call fecal loading or retention of stool, that's one of the first things we're going to address as well when we treat enuresis or bedwetting, is give them a stool softener and make sure that their tummies work well.
Sure.
So we're basically going to start with that. And then you alluded to it previously, the approach to fluid intake during the evening, prior to bed. So perhaps not going completely saying a child mustn't have any fluids from 5 or 6 at night.
Mm.
But it depends on when parents have dinner. I often find parents that have dinner a little bit later, so 7:30 or 8 o'clock or even 8:30. Perhaps they're very busy or transport or what, for whatever reason. These children, because they eat later, there's still fluid in the food, and then they might present with bedwetting more. So have an understanding with your child. Yes, you can have some fluid a little bit of water, 20 or 30 mils. And thereafter, if it still persists, then say, okay, from dinner onwards, nothing to eat or drink. But basically within an hour and a half of finishing dinner, there shouldn't be a significant amount of fluid that's consumed.
Mm.
All right. And then caffeinated beverages. So I think caffeinated beverages, there's a bit of controversy about it. But I tell parents, in older children, it's fine if they have coffee during the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But in the late afternoon and during the evening, I think caffeinated beverages, including Coca-Cola or some form of a soft drink containing caffeine, should be out.
Mm.
Right? And then thereafter, I think you probably will be asking me, or parents will be asking me about a bedwetting alarm. It's one of the non-pharmacotherapy or non-medicine options that we have. So a bedwetting alarm is basically a small pad that a child sleeps on. And this pad has a sensor in that the moment that there is any fluid on it, makes an audible sound alarm.
Hmm.
And this theory behind it is this creates a self-reinforced awareness. So the brain, once the child wakes up because of the alarm ringing, will then associate a full bladder and the want or the need to pass urine with awareness.
Mm.
Right? So they wake up prior to passing urine because the alarm has, by repetition, constituted or instituted that awareness in their mind.
Sure.
Bedwetting alarms don't work well in children that sleep deep. That's the main issue.
Mm.
I have many children, the parents went onto one of the online sites. There's quite a few of these alarms. I'm not going to mention trade names, but you can go and Google them for the parents.
Mm.
If your child sleeps deep, the chance of it not working is good. So, unfortunately, it doesn't work for everybody.
Mm.
There's also a lot of data out on the studies that have been done that after you've stopped the bedwetting alarm, once the child has attained nighttime continence, they don't bedwet, it recurs.
Yes.
Right? So, within 3 months, about, I think, 40 to 50% of children actually start wetting their beds again.
Which I think, for me, was going to be one of the questions to say, does it not weaken one's natural kind of, like, your natural muscle? I imagine that you're building the muscle to be able to recognize when you need to, you know, to go to the bathroom.
I think it has to do with awareness. So basically, your bladder that is stretched to capacity for your age at that point, telling your brain, listen, I am full, and that fullness perception or nerve conduction needs to pierce the conscience.
Mm.
So if a child sleeps very deep, your bladder might be full, the nerve is telling your brain, listen, I'm full, I need to go, but it's not getting through.
Yeah.
So that is part of the developmental process that a child usually attains once they've reached adulthood or once they become a little bit older. So now it actually reinforces that and makes them more aware. So they would become a little bit more aware of their bladders, and that's the theory behind how a bedwetting alarm works.
Okay, but once you take it away...
I think that's what I'm hearing is that once you take it away,
it almost feels like you have given me something that's going to assist me to deal with my issue, and then you take that away, and all of a sudden I'm not empowered.
Absolutely.
And I think for me that's where I sit with a little bit of a question around, is it really effective? But that's a conversation for another day. I think for me, one of the things I'm hearing, Doctor, is that, you know, I think we're encouraging those who are listening to the conversation to actually go to a urologist if we pick up that there's ongoing bedwetting. So it's persistent. And I think the importance of this is really to say that sometimes what presents as bedwetting could be a symptom of something bigger.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why it's so important to go and to get the correct diagnosis.
Absolutely.
Is this really, you know, a case of the, and I'm going to try to use the fancy term, monosymptomatic enuresis?
Absolutely. Is the only thing that
we're dealing with here, that bedwetting which presents at night, etc., or are there other issues? And bedwetting is simply a symptom of those.
Absolutely, you're hitting the nail on the head, because the other symptoms, so a child that constantly, while they're awake at school, complaining to a teacher or a parent, mommy, I need to go to the bathroom, or a child that develops urine tract infection, And needs to be admitted or has recurrent urinary tract infections and needs antibiotics constantly. Those are not symptoms or signs that we associate with monosymptomatic enuresis, and they are urgent. They need to be evaluated. Blood on a dipstick stick test that we did usually do at the general practitioner, that is not something associated with bedwetting. And then any other developmental abnormality, and now I'm speaking to the really rare things, but unfortunately you do see them. And I think it's the terrible fear of any parent that their children could have a terrible condition, whether it's an underlying cancer or a neurological condition. Unfortunately, incontinence is often one of the first symptoms associated with other conditions. So if you see your child struggling to walk, and I mean these are, as I say, the true exceptions, or they're losing weight, or there's a mass, or anything that is not typical of a healthy, growing, inquisitive, well-developing child, therein lies the urgency. These things need to be evaluated urgently. And by urgently, I mean within a week or two, not nothing longer than that.
So doctor, let's talk to treatments that you would not recommend. So I think sometimes as parents, we're guilty of going to Dr. Google, and Dr. Google says, this is what you should do. And I think we sometimes, can be blamed for not getting that second opinion. And by the time we go to the urologist, the urologist is saying, who told you to do this? And you're holding your phone up very shyly to say, I went to Dr. Google and they said, this is what I must do. What would you not recommend?
First of all, just a quick comment on Google. I encourage parents to go and Google, but also Google with a pinch of salt. If you want to have that information, just see how often it's recommended. And these days on social media, it's so easy to spread misinformation. I think if we just look at the news in South Africa and what we see, just for one second, take a step back and ask yourself, does this sound realistic? So caveat from the doctor, ask yourself, does it sound realistic? I mean, burning incense, and I'm not disrespectful or anything, but let's be realistic whether it's going to work or it's not going to work. I think we've alluded to one of the things that you should not be doing, and it doesn't link up with the pharmacotherapy, but it links up with conservative management, and that's the punitive measures. So please don't, because your child is wetting their beds, engage in spanking or anything that is going to affect them, and also, I mean, put the blame on them. My perception of children are they come to you with their simple need, either problem, or they won't even come to you with a problem. You need to help them with their problem and then realize you're in the position as the adult, as the parent, as the caretaker to address this. No child will willingly wet their beds and run the risk of being shamed or being embarrassed by the smell, by the rigmarole associated with a wet linen. So that's definitely pointing it out and telling them, listen, you're going to help us with this. We're going to support you as parents or caretakers in getting through this. That's important.
And I think, doctor, sorry, just to step in there to say, I think for me, listening to that, you know, just be mindful not to blame, because, you know, through some of the knowledge I've uncovered today, sometimes it is hereditary.
Absolutely.
Sometimes it is genetic.
Absolutely.
And it isn't the child to blame. There are other factors to consider. And I think in the light of that, we certainly shouldn't be blaming these children.
I always have a light moment in my practice if I sit in consultation with two parents. I ask the question, so is there any history, family history of bedwetting, and the mother looks at her father and he turns red? Because, I mean, then there's an obvious reason. And we don't have the exact number of genes or the exact definite genes that have been identified, but there's definitely a polygenic, so more than one gene,
sure.
And they are hereditary, and it can come from any of their parents, mother or father, so X or Y in the case of a boy. So, yes, it is hereditary, and I think just saying, listen, daddy also wet his bed when he was younger, but look, I mean, he's dry now, hopefully. we make sure that the children are supported by realizing this is not something we're abandoning to. Sort it out together. So in terms of that, back to the question, what treatments would I not recommend? I mean, there aren't, I've not come across many non-medical treatments. Parents usually know of the medical treatments, so there's not specifically anything that I can recommend, but specifically I want to emphasize the punitive measures when children do wet their beds. That's one thing that we should be avoiding.
Okay, and doctor, sometimes, I mean, we're living in South Africa, doctor, and I'm thinking about access to urologists. So maybe just give us a sense of, I mean, do we have widespread urologists? Am I able to kind of just, you know, find a urologist anywhere and everywhere? That's the first question. And the second question, I suppose, for me becomes then what would be, you know, the first point of contact necessarily? Does it always have to go to a urologist, or could I just simply go to a GP?
I think that's a very valid question. So just on your first question, the access, there are urologists at all big five of the quaternary, so-called quaternary hospitals in South Africa. So these are the designated hospitals by the Minister of Health. This is now the public sector, where we treat the most complex and obviously the most specialized of services. At Tibeko Hospital, we have a dedicated pediatric urology service. So if a parent wouldn't be able to access private health care, they'd be seeing me in the public hospital as well, or one of the junior doctors that I work with, and all the pharmacotherapeutics, so the medicine that we have in private, is also available at Tibeko. And perhaps then just a shout out, because I think what we do at Tibeko, we really try and offer a service that is on par with the best service that you'd be able to get in private. Anything and everything that you'd be able to get in private, if you don't have any medical aid, you'd be able to get at the pediatric urology service at Tibeko, including all of the new types of medicines that we treat incontinence and bedwetting with. So that's where we access. So typically these children, private or private, public or private, would access help from a general practitioner. The general practitioner, if they have an interest a little bit in pediatric health, would then institute some form of treatment, look at the constipation if it is associated, address that, ask a few questions, clarifying or looking for those red flag symptoms. Once those have been excluded, they're going to institute some form of treatment. And if that should fail, I think referral to a urologist at that point. So once first-line treatment has failed, they should be referring to a urologist. There are many parents, also parents that have access to medical aid, that would perhaps not feel comfortable taking their children to a general practitioner, or perhaps their GP just tells them straight, listen, I have no interest or no expertise in pediatric health, and then in those cases they can contact a urologist directly.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they've seen a urologist, there are some urologists that still say, I don't want to treat children for bedwetting, or it's not in something that I have an interest in. And in those cases, there are dedicated pediatric urologists or general urologists with an interest in pediatric urology, so focusing on children. These are eventually the specialists with which a parent, and also those parents with children that have refractory enuresis, should be seeing. And I hope to offer a service where we can say, listen, we've excluded all the serious stuff, and we can put parents' fears at ease.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Doctor. And maybe as we wrap up the conversation, I'm not sure if there are any common questions that you typically hear from parents that we may not have covered that you can share with us.
I think it links up with the more severe or the more refractory types of disease. So if you look at a retrospective evaluation of bedwetting, so looking back in terms of age, it's basically a curve that slowly decreases. So by 5 years, 60 to 70% of children will be dry.
Mm-hmm.
By 8 to 9 years, it slowly goes down. Eventually, when you get to 16 years of age, so slightly in puberty, there's still anything between 3 and 5% of patients. So 3 to 5 out of every 100 children or adolescents at that point, that will still be bedwetting. And I want to put out a word for those parents that have might have tried everything and spent a huge amount of money in an attempt to get the children dry. Once we reach that point, it is a no holds barred, because in these cases we search until we have an answer for what is causing bedwetting. And in some cases you still end up not finding a clear organic or neurological whatever cause for the bedwetting. And that's then where we really start using various types of medicine that aren't necessarily first or even second line treatment. And I think that's definitely a case for a specialist or specialist in the field that has a specific interest in refractory enuresis. So don't give up hope. Get to know who can help you. And if you get to the right person with an interest in the field, there's definitely something that we can still do.
I think that's very encouraging, and I think it's important, because I imagine that you deal with some cases where, you know, some parents have been on this journey for a very long time. It's become debilitating and frustrating both for the parents and for the child who's experiencing this. So I think, I mean, a word of thanks to you for that encouraging word. So parents, that's it. You know, go and get the treatment. Don't give up. You know, doctors will do the best they can to get to some sense of what is happening and how can we treat this. And then, doctor, maybe just as we close it off, this has been an empowering conversation, a couple of takeaways for the person who's sitting saying, you know, what do I take away from this conversation?
I think the most important thing is bedwetting is completely treatable. Don't have a sticker approach. The carrot approach is better. So a rewarding approach for bedwetting in children is more. And then if something is bothering you, I think I alluded to the red flag symptoms. The red flag symptoms should not be ignored. They should be addressed early on. And I think it's for me it's almost the, one of the most rewarding things to see in pediatric urology. If you have a child that perhaps has been in primary school for a while and was still bedwetting, couldn't engage socially, that you work up from A to Z, get to a point where the child is now dry at night, to see the change in their personality, because you're dealing with a completely different human being, somebody that's shy and that's pensive and perhaps not themselves, to a person that becomes engaging and you see this personality. So for me, that's one of the most engaging or rewarding things to see in pediatric urology once you treat bedwetting successfully.
Doctor, this has been insightful. This has certainly been empowering for me as a mother to little people. And I think for me, one of the biggest takeaways is to really say, you know, it's important to get a very clear sense of what the actual issue is if we start to pick up that this is persistent. So to go and to seek the necessary professional help. To help us to diagnose exactly what the issue is, one. But I think for me also just that, you know, that sensitivity, that care and that support, you know, that we can offer back at home. I think I take that with me as a big one, you know, to not be punitive, but rather to really show support for what this child is going through. So thank you so much. I really appreciate the time that you have dedicated to the conversation. And I know that this is going to be valuable to our listeners. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the hashtag BearingPod. Join the conversation by following us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube under Bearing South Africa. Have you been diagnosed with IBD? Download the Bearing IBD Health Diary app today. The Bearing IBD Health Diary app is available on the Apple App Store and the Android Google Play Store.